You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Arianna Siegel. Arianna is an actor, a comedian, and writer. She's a friend of a friend who I went to grad school with. And she's recently been certified as a coach for artists in the career and life coach kind of sense of the word. And I was interested to hear her perspective on mental health, among other things. Before I get to the interview, I wanted to say that this week has been overwhelming in the news and politics realm, but also really beautiful on Saturday with the Women's March. We went to the New York City March, and if you didn't get a chance to participate, wherever you are, Brittany Bond, who was on episode 7 of The Compass, took some beautiful images at the New York City March, and you can take a look at brittanybond.tumblr.com. I'm going to share an article by writer Margaret Atwood entitled What Art Under Trump. If you'd like to skip ahead to the interview, feel free. I hope you enjoy the 61st episode of The Compass. This is an article from The Nation, published January 19th, 2017, entitled What Art Under Trump? In a time of crisis and panic, artists and writers can help remind us that we are more than just voters and statistics. It's written by Canadian writer and poet Margaret Atwood. And just before I get started, be warned, this article is full of names, which I will attempt to pronounce correctly, and I'm sorry in advance if I am not entirely successful. Of what use is art? It's a question often asked in societies where money is the prime measure of worth, usually by people who do not understand art and therefore dislike it and the artists who make it. Now, however, the question is being posed by artists themselves. For American writers and other artists, there's a distinct chill in the air. Strong men have a well-earned reputation for suppression and for demanding fawning tributes. Suck up or shut up has been their rule. During the Cold War, many writers, filmmakers, and playwrights received visits from the FBI on suspicion of un-American activities. Will that history be repeated? Will self-censorship set in? Could we be entering an age of samizdat in the United States, with manuscripts circulating secretly because publishing them would mean inviting reprisal? That sounds extreme, but considering America's own history and the wave of authoritarian governments sweeping the globe, it's not out of the question. In the face of such uncertainties and fears, the creative communities of the United States are nervously urging one another not to surrender without a fight. Don't give up. Write your book. Make your art. But what to write or make? 50 years from now, what will be said about the art and writing of this era? The Great Depression was immortalized by John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, which described in detail what the Dust Bowl years felt like to those living through them at the lowest level of American society. Arthur Miller's play The Crucible provided an apt metaphor for McCarthyism with its witch hunts and mass accusations. Klaus Mann's 1936 novel Mephisto, about the rise of a famous actor, showed absolute power corrupting an artist absolutely, a fitting story during the reign of Hitler. What sorts of novels, poems, films, television series, video games, paintings, music, or graphic novels will adequately reflect America's next decade? We don't have any idea yet. We can't. Nothing is predictable except unpredictability. It's probably fair to say, however, that Donald Trump's interest in the arts, gauged on a scale from 1 to 100, is somewhere between 0 and negative 10, lower than any president in the last 50 years. Some of those presidents didn't give a hoot about the arts, but at least they found it politic to pretend. Trump won't. In fact, he may not even notice they're there. This might, in fact, work to our advantage. Stalin and Hitler took an interest in the arts and considered themselves experts and arbiters, which was very bad news for the writers and artists whose styles displeased the authorities. These got packed off to the gulag or condemned as degenerate. Hopefully, most creative people will find themselves flying under the radar, so insignificant as to escape detection. The United States has no gulags. It prefers to express displeasure through behind-the-scenes blackballing. The screenwriter's phone doesn't ring, as it didn't for the Hollywood Ten. The musician's songs go unplayed, as Buffy St. Marie's were during the Vietnam War because of her song, Universal Soldier. The writer's book fails to find a publisher, as was the case for many years, with Marilyn French's From Eve to Dawn, A History of Women in the World. A change in the overall cultural climate may well be expected, with rewards of various kinds flowing to those willing to ride along in the wake of the incumbent powerboat, and quiet punishments meted out to those who refuse. Those reprisals may take the form of noxious POTUS tweets, like the recent one in which Trump kicked his Celebrity Apprentice successor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, right in the ratings, or vulgar public denunciations, like his dismissal of Meryl Streep after the Golden Globe speech implicitly criticized Trump as a bully. And what will happen to freedom of speech, that hallmark of American democracy? Will the very idea become a euphemism for hate speech and internet bullying, a hammer to whack political correctness? That has already begun. If it intensifies, will those defending the concept of free speech then be attacked from the left as collaborators with fascists? Surely we can look to the artists to uphold our better values. Don't they represent the most noble features of the human spirit? Not necessarily. Creative people come in many makes and models. Some are merely paid entertainers, opportunists out to make $1 million. Some have more sinister agendas. There's nothing inherently sacred about films and pictures and writers and books. Mein Kampf was a book. Plenty of creative people in the past have rolled over for the powerful. In fact, they're especially subject to authoritarian pressures because, as isolated individuals, they're very easy to pick off. No armed militia of painters protects them. No underground mafia of screenwriters will put a horse's head in your bed if you cross them. Those under attack may be defended verbally by other artists, but such defense counts for little if a ruthless establishment is bent on their destruction. The pen is mightier than the sword, but only in retrospect. At the time of combat, those with the swords generally win. But this is America. It has a long and honorable history of resistance, and its multi-voiced and multifaceted variety will itself be some defense. There will, of course, be protest movements, and artists and writers will be urged to join them. It will be their moral duty, or so they will be told, to lend their voices to the cause. Artists are always being lectured on their moral duty, a fate other professionals, dentists, for example, generally avoid. But it's tricky telling creative people what to create, or demanding that their art serve a high-minded agenda crafted by others. Those among them who follow such hortatory instructions are likely to produce mere propaganda or two-dimensional allegory, tedious sermonizing either way. The art galleries of the mediocre are wallpapered with good intentions. What then? What sort of genuine artistic response might be possible? Maybe social satire? Perhaps someone will attempt the equivalent of Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, which suggested the consumption of babies as an economic solution to Irish poverty. But satire, alas, tends to fall flat when reality exceeds even the wildest exaggerations of the imagination, as it is increasingly doing today. Science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction have often been used to register protest in times of political pressure. They have told the truth, but told it slant, as Yevgeny Zamyatin did in his 1924 novel We, which anticipated the Soviet repressions to come. Many American writers took to science fiction in the McCarthy years because it allowed them to criticize their society without being too easily spotted by the powers intent on quashing criticism. Some will produce witness art, like those artists who have responded to great catastrophes, wars, earthquakes, genocides. Surely the journal keepers are already at work. inscribing events and their responses to them, like those who kept accounts of the Black Death until they themselves succumbed to it, or like Anne Frank writing her diary from her attic hiding place, or like Samuel Pepys, who wrote down what happened during the Great Fire of London. Works of simple witnessing can be intensely powerful, like Nawal el-Sadawi's Memoirs from the Woman's Prison, about her time behind bars in Anwar Sadat's Egypt, or Jan Lianke's Four Books, which chronicles the famines and mass deaths in China during the Great Leap Forward. American artists and writers have seldom been shy about exploring the fissures and cracks in their own country. Let's hope that if democracy implodes and free speech is suppressed, someone will record the process as it unfolds. In the short run, perhaps all we can expect from artists is only what we have always expected. As once solid certainties crumble, it may be enough to cultivate your own artistic garden, to do what you can, as well as you can, for as long as you can, do it, to create alternate worlds that offer both temporary escapes and moments of insight, to open windows in the given world that allow us to see outside it. With the Trump era upon us, it's the artists and writers who can remind us, in times of crisis or panic, that each one of us is more than just a vote, a statistic. Lives may be deformed by politics, and many certainly have been, but we are not, finally, the sum of our politicians. Throughout history, it has been hope for artistic work that expresses, for this time and place, as powerfully and eloquently as possible, what it is to be human. All right, well, the question that I always start out with is, how do you keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
That's
really great.
7 years of therapy.
Lovely.
Anti-anxiety meds, which I just
also lovely.
A few months ago. And
have you felt a big difference?
Changed my life.
Really?
Like, the fact that it took me so long to get on them makes me so sad. Like, what would my 20s have been like if I had been properly medicated? But okay, whatever. Things happen for a reason. and I'm also a practicing Buddhist, so that...
Okay.
That and the meds, I feel like, have been the biggest. They keep me sane.
Has the Buddhism been around for a long time in your life?
2 years, about. Totally changed my life, too. And it's a practice that I do every day, so I have to, like, you know, like, the pills I take, and they're great, but it's a pretty passive part of my day. But, like, my I chant, and that's, like, super intentional. And that's, you know, I try to do... I'm supposed to chant at night, too, but I definitely do morning, and that's usually, like, half an hour at the smallest amount, and if I can do, like, an hour of it, it's really good.
And what does the dark side usually look like for you? How does it manifest in your life?
The dark side, I feel like I'm not as in the dark side right now, so I feel like I'm like, talking about a part of myself that was, like, more in my 20s, but it's a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of tying my value as a person to my success as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And success, like, in a very specific way. And then, like, there's a spiral of, like, oh, I didn't hear back from this person I pitched this thing to. Oh, my God, I'm never going to hear back. Oh, my God, I'm a terrible writer. Oh, my God, I'm never going to get paid. I'm going to live on the streets. I'm going to die alone. Like,
right.
Just go really quickly. From A to Z. But not as much on these meds, which is amazing. Like, I'll try, if I tried to have one of those thoughts right now, it, like, wouldn't. Just happen. So a part of me kind of misses that part because it felt very much like that's who I am, but it wasn't a helpful part. And it was really like, I feel like I spent 70% of my day just getting myself out of a spiral.
Yeah.
And then the 30% I could do work.
That's so much energy.
It's so much energy, and I was really good at keeping it. Yeah.
And so I know you're a writer. Mm-hmm. You said, and a comedian. Are you an actor as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do mostly voiceover work now, which I love, especially if you're as lazy as me. It's perfect.
Can you do it from home?
Yeah, I can't. Well, I mostly go to my agency to record, but I do sometimes audition from home, and I just go into my closet and, like, sit amongst my clothes and record voices from my closet. So I'm, like, in my pajamas, and it's great. Such a great deal.
And I know that you do coaching now for acting.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, like, how that came about?
It's not coaching for acting. It is creativity coaching.
For actors. I'm sorry. Exactly. Not for acting. Yeah, so
like,
no.
I don't want to tell you how to make it better.
Or is it for any type of artist?
It's for any type of artist or creative.
Okay.
So I feel like that spans like a large amount of people. Now I was so afraid people were going to be like, can you help me get into grad school? And I'd be like, I don't know. I'm sorry. Things go somewhere else. Yeah. So I just got certified as a professional coach through Coaching for Transformation. It's a program at the Open Center accredited by the International Coaching Federation. So it's a real thing. It's a real certificate. And yeah, I help artists or creatives overcome their blocks, which we all have so many of, and like really get in touch with all those voices versus like, I don't know. I just feel like there's so much coaching. It's like, just like be positive and like just love yourself. And it's like, okay, that's cute, but let's like really engage with those more difficult parts, the dark side,
yeah.
Right? Because there's so much wisdom in the dark side, and the dark side lives with us forever. We just learn to manage it better. It's not like I'm going to wake up and not be anxious. Those voices will live with me, but now it's like I deal with them in a better way. I have some empathy for them because they're a part of me that's like just trying to protect me. And underneath that part is like a wounded part of ourselves, right? So it's really about how do we engage with these parts of ourselves? How do we have compassion for these parts of ourselves and not repress those parts of ourselves? How, you know, have that conversation and then move towards our goals and really figure out what we value, what's important to us, making sure our goals aren't goals that like someone else has that we sort of decided we should have or that our parents thought we should have, like really digging into what we value and then moving from that space. So, you know, I had all kinds of goals in my 20s that I didn't really want, but I thought I was supposed to want. Also, the things we value change. So, like, what I value at 22 is different than 32. So, that's basically what I do when I actually do workshops for creatives. I have a workshop called Fuck Brand, What's Your Mission? And it's exactly that. It's, like, really exploring, like, what's our brand and, like, how does the world view us? What about that is useful? What about that is bullshit? Because there's so much more than that. And then digging into why we make art. Especially now that the world is ending. Like, we can't just be making shit willy-nilly. It needs to be connected to, like, what's important to us. That doesn't mean we have to make political work. It just means that we have to make work that's in alignment with what we care about and then just let go of the rest. Yeah.
So what made you decide that you wanted to go through that training and pursue that?
So it was really sad. I had started, like, achieving some success in my career, and I was still really sad. I was like, wait.
That's not supposed to happen.
I thought if I book these things, then, like, I'm happy. Fuck. And then I also had this realization that it was sort of happening on a larger level to a lot of other people, like people that were way more successful than me. I had a conversation with Andrea Martin, actually, which was amazing. I met her at Williamstown, and she got a coffee with me, like, the following winter. And you know, I sort of assumed it would be, like, easy street for her. She's Andrea Martin. She's won a ton of Tonys. But she was like, yeah, once I started getting older, the phone stopped ringing. And I was, like, depressed for 2 years. And I was like, you know, in my late 50s. And she was like, am I going to work again? Is this it?
Yeah.
And she said she was really depressed. But then she decided she was going to do a one-woman show at the Public. And she said it was the best thing she ever did. And I was like, fuck, this can happen to Andrea Martin. Like, it can happen. It's going to happen to me. So really, I saw, it wasn't like I was so afraid of failing. I was like, oh, I'm going to get successful and still be unhappy. That's really fucked up. Like, so I had that moment, and I was at the end of my 20s, and I was like, okay, so being an artist is important, but I can't tie my success to it. What else? What brings me value and meaning? And I'd been in therapy for a long time, and I'd also been the recipient of some coaching, and I was like, I feel like I want to help people. And I was also a big sister. I'm part of the 52nd Street program, so I had a kid that I worked with who was amazing for 7 years. So I worked with him from when he was in sixth grade till when he just graduated.
That's awesome.
It was like the best part of my week.
Yep.
Better than auditions, better than anything. It was just a time I wasn't worried about my own shit, and I could focus on him, and he just brought me so much joy. And I was like, I love that. But a part of me was like, you can't worry about other people. You just got to worry about your own success. And I felt really ashamed that I wanted to help people. I felt like, I felt kind of shameful about it. So I sort of had told myself, whatever, it's just a volunteer thing. But the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you know what? Everyone comes to me for advice. I like helping people. Maybe, like, coaching is what I need to be doing. And I've also taught before. So I went on a limb. I threw down a ton of money for this 9-month program last summer. And I just did it. And I loved it. And it uses so many of the skills that you develop as an actor, which is why I'm really good at it.
Yeah, I'm sure listening and empathy and listening, that's a huge part of it.
Yeah, and I found even, like, in acting, like, I can listen, but, like, am I deeply listening? Like, at an audition, like, I'm kind of listening, but I'm also kind of in my head, and I'm also kind of thinking about lunch. You know, I'm, like, doing some good surface listening. But with coaching, you are listening, like, on some super, super deep levels. Like, you're listening to what the client's saying. You're listening to the subtext. You're listening to their facial expressions. You're listening to their tears. And then you're just listening to, like, the energy and the intuition that's happening between you two. And it's just really intimate. And I just love being intimate with strangers. I don't know why. But, like, when people tell me their secrets.
That's lovely.
Yeah. So that's what got me into it.
What has your experience been since you got your certification, like, trying to build that as a business and finding clients and kind of negotiating?
Why have I found one more thing that is so difficult?
Well, because it's something you love so much, but, like, the part of it that's also to, you know, make you money and
do all that. All the things I love are hard to do. I'm going to be a dentist.
It's like, I know. We all think that at one time or another.
It's really hard for me, you know, like, I gotta get my shit together. I have clients, I've, you know, written articles on mental health, I have workshops I've done, but, like, I need to organize my shit. So it's hard, but I think that I really care about what I do, and I really care about people, and if I just stay in that place, then it helps the whole business part be less stressful. Because I feel like with performing, it's like there's that 2% where you're, like, in it, and then there's so much bullshit around it. There's, like, auditions, there's representation, there's callbacks, there's the fact that you can book a pilot and then it doesn't go anywhere. But I feel like with coaching, there's a larger percentage of it that I just get to truly enjoy without worrying about all this other
actually
stuff.
Get to do the thing.
Yeah, so I'm really just trying to think about how much I enjoy doing the thing, and also, like, what's great is, like, now that I'm the coach, I can kind of coach myself, so I can be like, why are you avoiding business stuff? Let's tap into that. And sort of, like, ask myself these questions and not be so hard on myself.
Yeah.
I'm a professional at being really hard on myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of artists are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of it is just asking the hard questions.
Yeah.
Which we can all do to some extent for ourselves if we really put our mind to it.
Yeah, I think it's...
get around those blocks.
Elizabeth Gilbert talks a lot about just being curious.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, instead of being like, why do you suck at business? Why are you so shitty with money? Just being like, that's a curious thing about you. We should explore that. Curiosity versus, like, you suck, which is, like, the voice in my head most of the time.
I like that.
Yeah,
totally. How does your family take in your choice to be an artist, to live your life as an artist? Are there any other artists in your family?
Mm-hmm. Come from a doctor and a CPA, and my brother's a lawyer. But they've always been really, really supportive, which is awesome. I don't know if I could have gotten this far if they weren't supportive. Like, my friends that don't have supportive parents, I'm just like, damn.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's really nice.
Yeah, it's super nice.
Do they get to come up and see your work ever? Or?
Yeah, they come to see a lot of plays. My mom's been really good. She's so sweet. She'll see, like, a show 3 times because she doesn't see.
That's the way my mom is, too. They would love it.
It's different every night. I'm like, oh. Like, so they're art appreciators, which I like. I almost feel like they are way more excited about the art than the coaching, but that's okay.
Well,
they spent all that money on NYU for my acting degree. So they're not looking for the return on that.
Well, and it's something that they can see. Like, when you're actually doing projects, they can see tangibly what it is.
That's true. They're big fans. I do a lot of stuff for the web, and they like to quote my work, which is really funny. And
So you've been in New York since undergrad at NYU.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about it these days? Do you think you'll stick around, or?
I feel like I'm going to become, like, the old ladies things with the Christini's bags, you know, like in the cart. I feel like if I don't leave eventually, I'm getting close to becoming that lady, which is like a hunchback. I don't want to raise a family here, and I don't want to grow old here. But then there's a lot of gray space in between now and then.
Right.
I don't know. LA always looks promising. I want a dog in a backyard. But I also have spent some time in LA, and if you're not like really working that 9 to 5 or something super regular, it will swallow you. You'll be like, I have to get a taco. I'm so tired. Like, I'm so tired there, and I didn't do anything. I don't know what it is.
There's something about New York of just being able to walk out the door and like walk anywhere or get on a train that does make it easier not to isolate yourself.
I really need nature, and
that's true.
Enough of it here.
No,
like,
me too.
I feel like when I'm in nature, I feel so much better, and being in the city often just physically makes me feel like a garbage can. I just want to sit in the tree and not hear like a police siren.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, how can I have this be my home base, but then spend time out in LA, and then also with the coaching, I want to be doing retreats and stuff. And how can I go out to cool places and be in nature and do this kind of work? Also, the voiceover is cool because you can kind of do it from wherever.
That's true. Yeah. So, how did you first get into voiceovers?
I lucked into it. I don't think I would have gotten into it if I tried, because it's really kind of hard to break into. So
that's what I've heard.
I had a commercial agent, and I guess I was signed for voiceover, and no one told me about it. And then they just started sending me out, and I was like, oh crap, I don't know anything about this. So I started working with a coach, and then I've just been doing that ever since, and I just like it, because I just always grew up doing a lot of voices, and I'm really lazy, and I don't like dressing up for things, so it really just like suits me very well.
It's the perfect combination.
Totally.
And then for your writing and comedy work, are you somebody who likes to work alone, or do you have collaborators who you have built relationships with? You guys kind of work as a team?
Yeah, I built a sketch comedy group out right out of college that we were together for a long time, and then from that, me and my writing partner started working together. So we've been working together for like 8 years.
We've oh wow!
A ton of stuff. We've worked for HGTV and College Humor, and then we just got hired as staff writers for the show for True TV, which is our first TV writing job. So it was
awesome
to have her next to me every day. Also, we might have like wanted to kill each other after spending 10 hours a day with each other. But so we're both doing our own thing right now, but I'm sure we're going to come together pretty soon to do something. I think we're going to do a fundraising show. Post-election fundraising show with some good storytellers. So she's amazing. I met her at NYU. We both did sketch comedy, and she was like the only other tiny Jewish woman. And I was like, we're either going to kill each other or become best friends. So we decided to become best friends.
That's great.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, how do you guys deal with that? Like when you are under pressure, you've spent too much time together and you have disagreements, like as creatives.
You know what? No problem working together as creatives. I think it's spending time together as humans. we've worked together under crazy stressful situations, and we just like share a brain at this point. We know what she's good at. We know what I'm good at. We have no ego in like what gets cut, whose idea it is. It's very, we just like want, we're just both committed to excellence and working really, really hard. And I think that's why we work together, because we're tireless. We're like crazy tireless people. And we're perfectionists. So yeah, working together, we never fight about that stuff. It's kind of just sometimes like friendship stuff, like any other friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you learned anything through your coaching that you feel like has changed the way that you audition?
Yes.
Or like the way you handle nerves or anxiety around auditions?
And not a coaching answer.
Okay.
So as Buddhists, we talk about like, how do we bring value to each situation, and how do we make each situation count? So instead of just being like, oh, whatever, it's just a stupid audition, or like, I'm not going to get it, really being like, how can I bring like love and compassion, and how can I bring love and compassion into this room right now? Not even like, how can I do the best acting job, Like, how can I just, like, walk into the room being like, I'm full of compassion for these people, and I'm just, like, so glad to be here with these people, you know, and just feeling grateful. Because then it puts this, I think it sort of, like, sends that outward energy versus, like, being all in yourself and being like, did I do a good job? Did I do a good job? Yeah, I think it's just really about, like, honoring the people you're auditioning for. I know that sounds kind of weird, but it's really helpful. And I think people pick up on that energy.
Hmm. Is there anything in the past few years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? Like, a lesson you've learned?
Yeah. Well, I mean, writing for this TV show is amazing. Like, to write something and then see it on TV really was like, oh, I'm manifesting. And, that was really huge. And I also had this experience last fall where I was speaking at a Buddhist meeting and, telling this story about how what I've gotten from my Buddhism more than anything is just like having more faith in myself. And even if things take a long time, like, I have faith that in the end I'm going to make it happen. And encountering obstacles are just a way to heighten my resilience and my resolve. They actually are an opportunity for me to deepen my faith and deepen my faith in myself and my resolve. So basically I gave this speech about how I like went on 60 auditions. It was just a year where I just went on a ton of auditions and I didn't get anything and I pitched a ton of stuff and I didn't go anywhere. And what I got was, it was the first time since ever where I was like, you know what? This is a great opportunity for me to just tell myself that, like, I'm really going to go for it versus being like, I suck. This means I'm never going to achieve anything. So Duncan Sheik happened to be at this meeting because he's a member of our district, and New York Magazine was doing a profile on him, and they included me in the profile. So I was like, I was so happy to be in New York Magazine just, like, talking about my struggles as an artist and, like, my resilience as a Buddhist. And I was like,
I'm glad they caught me in that moment.
Yeah, right?
Instead of a different one.
And Duncan just said it was the best experience he ever heard. He's been practicing for 25 years. So, yeah. So I felt really good about that. It's so funny. I feel like the stuff I'm most proud of is not even like the achievement. It's like that process. The process really care about. It's never like any award I've ever gotten. It's like, okay, that's cool. But it's always just like the process of making stuff, being on set and writing and being in the booth and being with a client. It's always like the unsexy stuff that has the most meaning, not like the achievement-y in the traditional sense part. It's always, that always feels a little like meh.
Can we talk a little bit about like day jobs and stuff?
Yeah.
I know it sounds like maybe, I don't know if you're making your whole living from voiceovers and creative work at this point, but how have you kind of pieced together that puzzle over the years?
Yeah. So this year was the first year I made all my money from my art.
Congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's awesome.
Thank you. So that was really good, but it's never promised. Right now I'm making money from coaching. And I also work as a bar mitzvah singer.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I'm a part of a Jewish a cappella group that sings at bar mitzvahs.
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic. Other crazy day jobs, I was a gym teacher. I was a regular teacher. I taught after school, like, playwriting and comedy writing for kids. What other things? I've been a server and a barista and a bartender. I was also a stripper for one night.
One eventful night,
I was a stripper. I made a lot of money, but then I was like, nah, I'm good. What else have I done that's been weird? I think the stripping and the bar mitzvah singing and the gym teacher are the weirdest.
That's one of the big themes of the podcast is, like, how do artists find balance when they're making a lot of wonderful work but not necessarily making their entire living from it? And how you can kind of keep your self-confidence and when you're not getting that financial validation, you know?
I have to say, though, I mean, the reason I started coaching also because I was like, I don't want to wait tables anymore. But I do believe that, like, the skill sets that you have as as an artist, whether you're a writer or an actor, can be translated to other things. So there may be a day job that's actually really in alignment with your values and the things that you're good at, so you're not stuck doing some random job that has no meaning for you. You know what I mean? Like, I worked with a client who was, like, telling me about, she's a stand-up comedian, and she was telling me about, like, how much she loves animals. And I was like, you don't need to be... I mean, you can be waiting. If you want to wait tables, that's great. I mean, sometimes there's something to be said for something where it's like, I just go, I don't put energy into it.
It's flexible.
It's flexible. It's fine. But I was like, you should consider, like, doing some sort of veterinary stuff. So, like, I feel like there's a way to find day jobs that are just, like, an expansion of the skill sets that you already have or the values that you already have as an artist. So I also challenge artists to think about that, too, because... I don't know, I feel like we're told our stuff is, you know, like, our talents are, like, useless. But they're not. Being an actor, like, you know, like, you can help people with public speaking. Like, there's just so much you can do with the skill sets that you have as a performer. You know, that can translate into a lot of stuff. I also know another comedian that does motivational speaking for colleges. There's just, like, so much. If you can think of it, it exists. And I feel like now...
Someone will pay you for it.
The gig economy is sort of, like, up to us to manifest it in a lot of ways. Though I made a lot of money serving, so that was really great. No shame.
Are there any other aspects of the coaching or, like, the mental health conversation that you want to touch on that I'm not asking you about? That you think would be really valuable?
I think that I spoke to someone about this. I was really afraid I would lose. If I lost my anxiety, I would, like, lose my drive. Because I feel like I was driven by fear. Like, the fear of, like, not keeping up with my peers. Like, which really has driven me.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of like heightened feelings can be addictive. Because you feel like you're doing something because you're having to struggle against it.
And being like, that's my brand. I'm a neurotic Jew. That's my whole bit. but really realizing that my creativity doesn't come from anxiety. It comes from, like, my essence of who I am. And I've always had it. So I think people romanticize all that garbage of, like, being depressed and anxious. And, I mean, I know so many talented people that are dealing with addiction and depression and anxiety and all kinds of things that go untreated. And I just want to advocate for mental health, however that looks, whether it's meds, whether it's therapy, whether it's, you know, Eastern medicine, whether it's support groups. Because that's actually how you're going to tap into your creativity. All that stuff really takes you away from your creativity. So I just really want, because then it's like, then you have Amy Winehouse and you have, like, all these really talented people that kill themselves. It's like,
and that some people romanticize.
And some people, they're like, oh, well, you know,
that's a real artist. Yeah.
I'm sad or unless I'm depressed. Well, it's like, how long do you want to be doing this for? I'm trying to be in the biz till I'm old.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make it till 80. This anxious. I'm not even going to make it another 5 years this anxious. So it's like, if we're in it to win it, we need to, like, really, it's like a marathon. It's like, are you going to wear shitty Converse and, like, eat a ton of hamburgers before you run a marathon? No, you need to self-care and have all the proper tools so you can fucking run the marathon.
Yeah.
And no better time to start than in your 20s and 30s. Like, do not wait till you're 60. You know, or start. If you're 60, start. It's a great time to start. It doesn't matter how old you start. But I feel like the younger, the better. I think it helps your chances. So anyway, I just want to say that.
No, that's great.
I'm just going to get over it. I'm over it. It's not.
So if you are having a day where you're feeling really uninspired or down or writer's block or however that manifests for you, what are the, like, concrete things that you reach for again and again, like a book, or, I mean, it sounds like you're chanting, a place you go, anything like that?
I say go get some art, like, go consume some art, like, go see a show, or, like, go to a museum. I find that once I start seeing art, I, like, it revs me up again.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel like I do this thing where, like, if I don't feel inspired, I mean, if you don't feel inspired, you have to work anyway a lot of the time. So it's like, I set a timer for an hour, and I just write, and I tell myself, it can suck, it doesn't matter if it sucks, it doesn't matter if this is total garbage, but this is my job. So So I have to sit here for an hour and do this. And sometimes it'll stop for 20 minutes and then, like, it'll start to rev up again. But I think we put too much emphasis on, like, being inspired. I think a lot of it is, like, shitty grunt work of, like, showing up to the computer and doing it. You don't have to be happy while you work always. You know what I mean? Like, you can feel like garbage, or you can feel sad, or you can feel blocked and still show up and put some words on the paper. Or, like, go to that audition. You know, you can feel like garbage, but as long as you go and you do it, and, like, you did your job. And I think that that can be enough. You know? I also think rewards are really good. I buy myself pieces of jewelry when I've either when I've achieved something really great or when I've had a really, really sad failure. To be like, you tried really, really hard.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. My writing partner got me to do that, and it's changed my life. Because I'm like, oh, well, I didn't get that job. So guess someone's getting a new bracelet.
Yeah, and then you get to see those items and remind you of, mm-hmm. of your hard work.
Yeah.
And then, is there anything that you've seen lately that you want to recommend? Like a friend's show or anything?
Oh my God, that's really good. I am enjoying TV-wise, because I watch a lot of TV. I'm kind of bad about seeing theater. I want to recommend, first of all, we all need to be watching BoJack Horseman.
Oh, I don't know about this.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Where do you watch such a thing?
What channel is it on? Is it on FX or is it on Netflix? I forget. But it's a cartoon for adults, and it's basically about this, like, sitcom actor from the 90s who's super washed up, and just, it's about, like, the pitfalls of Hollywood and fame and hating yourself. It's like, it's actually our conversation today.
In animated form.
And everyone's an animal for the most part. It's really dark, it's really sad, it's really beautiful.
Okay.
And I also am really enjoying Atlanta.
Yes, I've started watching it. I haven't gotten too far yet.
So good.
That's what I keep hearing.
And really smart, and I feel like it's making its own category in comedy. That's really, really great. And I started watching Insecure too.
Yeah, that's great too. I love that. I binge watched that.
I know, like, a lot of really good smart comedy happening right now. And as much as, like, I am really depressed post-election, I'm really excited and curious about how it's going to inspire the next year of comedy, and how it's going to inspire comedy in me, because I haven't quite figured out, like, how I want to respond as a comedian to what's going on, because I'm really trying to work through some feelings, but I'm really, really excited, and I'm curious to see what kind of art it's going to manifest, not just in comedy, but in music, and
yeah,
I think it'll be interesting, for sure. Some interesting, really, like, heartfelt stuff is going to come out of it.
Yeah. And then what's the name of the show that you were writing for, the True TV show?
Oh, it was this show called Almost Genius.
Okay, so people can check it out.
Yeah, please check it out. I know the show is no longer, I think we're done. I'm not sure if we're renewed for another season. But, yeah, I'm back to the, like, looking for a job place.
Awesome.
It's a cycle.
It is a cycle. We have to do it over and over.
Yeah.
And is there, do you have, like, a website for your coaching, or if anyone wants to get in touch with you?
If you want to get in touch with me, you can just find me at ArianaSiegel.com. So that's ArianaSiegel.com. I don't have a specific coaching website yet, but you can just go to my website.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.